We're gonna fix that technical problem.
Tick tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC,
NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News, breaking news,
faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
Worked at ABC News, worked at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
General Ivan, thank you, sir.
There was never a question raised in the mainstream media about why we should really be going to war, only when we were going to go to war.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
Managing the message. Well, that's certainly a theme of our media today. And it's also, an example, if you will, of how easily, in a way, a population can be programmed into accepting a policy or going to war without really examining or explaining its rationale and reasons. And so, you know, this is the challenge that we have of trying to analyze media. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on Media Channel Radio, and welcoming this week Anya Stiglitz, who's written an amazing book, 100 Years of Investigative Journalism from Around the World. For 100 years, she's been compiling this document and reading investigative reporting, in a sense, saying that right now we are in a golden age of investigative reporting, even as many of us who are critics are so, unhappy with the direction the media has taken. But yet there are a lot of new forces in the media who are really going deeper, looking at stories, exposing problems, getting into leaked information and the like. So, it seems to be cutting both ways. On the one hand, more trivia, more celebrity-oriented information, less in-depth coverage, and at the same time, more investigative reporting, or what Anya here calls global muckraking. Tell me a little bit about this effort on your part.
Danny, thank you so much for having me. The idea for the book started when I was asked to co-teach a class at Columbia Journalism School on the history of business and economic journalism since 1600 in the United States, UK, Africa, and India. And that's an enormous task, and I was told I was supposed to teach about the history of journalism in Africa and India since 1600. So I spent...
Now, I was only joking before when I suggested that we've been doing this in real time since 1600. You know that.
Well, okay. It felt like that while I was preparing. So I spent about a year reading old newspapers, and I had researchers helping me, and also reading books about journalism. And for me, the kind of revelatory moment was when I read King Leopold's Ghost by Adam Hochschild.
Fantastic book.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you love it. For a lot of people, it's really a foundational text. And Adam Hochschild argues that the campaign for better labor conditions in the Congo was the first modern human rights campaign. And he profiles the journalist E.D. Morrell, who was so outraged by the conditions there that he set up a newspaper called the West African Mail and started covering them. Of course, that was a difficult thing to do. He was in Europe. It was very hard to communicate with the Congo. He relied on firsthand accounts from missionaries and travelers and all kinds of people. But when I finished this book, I thought, holy cow, I've been a journalist for years. I'm teaching journalism. How come I didn't know about this incredible journalism in the 19th century? And who else, we hear about the muckrakers, about Upton Sinclair and Ida Tarbell, and, who else was doing investigative journalism in the 19th century?
It's a very Western, Eurocentric, if you will, Americocentric, approach to journalism history. And the efforts of people who had far more serious obstacles to overcome, challenges to transcend in other countries, looking at crises like what was happening in Leopold's Congo, really deserve a tremendous amount of respect and attention, which unfortunately they haven't really received.
That's absolutely right. So after that, I saw that what happened was there was coverage in the Amazon by an editor called Benjamin Saldana Roca, who was horrified by the conditions on the rubber plantations there. And he had his own newspaper called La Sanción, and he started campaigning against this company, which was listed in the London Stock Exchange. From there, I kept reading, and then I discovered all these things I just, you know, hadn't known about. For example, 1906, there was a boycott of Cadbury's chocolate because people were worried about the supply chain and the conditions in the cocoa plantations in Sao Tome and Principe. So all of these things that I thought of as new, like, you know, the anti-sweatshop boycotts, it turned out that there were journalists writing about these things all over the world for decades. So that was how the idea of the book was born.
Well, that's a good sign and perhaps a troubling one as well. Troubling in the sense that we're still fighting some of these same battles that we've been fighting all these years for transparency, for accountability, for information about what the so-called private sector is doing. And, you know, Congo is a good, example of slavery and slave conditions, and the movement there, the anti-slavery movement actually from England, and, you know, what really ignited the anti-slavery movement in our country. In fact, there's a book out today suggesting that Americans were not happy with the British campaign against slavery because they felt it would undo slavery in America. And they opposed the British for that reason.
Well, you're absolutely right that these were global campaigns and that they haven't gotten enough attention and have really largely been forgotten today. So I started collecting examples of journalism from around the world, and I tried really hard to have reporters from developing countries. So the book that I edited has 47 pieces of journalism. And then what I realized while I was into it was that it's actually more old journalism is old journalism, and it can be hard for the modern reader. So I also got scholars, activists, and historians to write introductions to each piece of journalism and to explain what impact it had or didn't have. So we have pieces on Nike in Indonesia, on Liz Claiborne sweatshops in South America, on the Foxconn factory in China. We have pieces on by a Mozambique journalist writing about corruption, a journalist from Angola writing about corruption. We've got pieces from the dictatorship of Pinochet in Chile and about the Turkish military. So the idea is to show, in a way, that journalists have been writing about these subjects in many different places over time.
You know, my own company was called Global Vision, and we did a documentary on globalization and human rights that looked at a number of these cases and were, really impressed by the courage of the people on the ground who were fighting these battles and in a sense dismayed that our media didn't do more, in a sense, to make the connections, to explain the challenges that people had and the role the United States played in many instances in supporting really oppressive companies and regimes.
Well, I'm really glad you did that project because I agree with you. And it's the reaction to the book has just been tremendous. I've showed pieces of it, and I've got, a nice sort of PowerPoint with pictures of these newspapers. I mean, when I was reading these old newspapers, they were crumbling in my hands. You know, Ghanaian newspapers from 1961, British newspapers from the Indian newspapers from the 19th century. And I went to libraries in Delhi and Calcutta, Library of Congress, and also in London, and I had a team of researchers who spoke Turkish, Swahili, French, and then I had all these historians and scholars around the world, and it's been really great for people to see these pieces of journalism that they didn't know before.
You know, I had this experience as a news dissector in Boston when I worked in radio there, and I was a writer, and I began clipping articles, and I, became a bit obsessive and had filing cabinets filled with articles and the like. Fast forward some years later, we were doing the mediachannel.org. We were starting it. And I, went through my files and found all these articles about Rupert Murdoch in the early days of his empire building. And, because I was able to have articles from lots of different publications in one folder, so you could really compare and contrast coverage, okay? And so I brought it into the office, okay? And we had a young team of people working on it all, and they said, "What's that?" So these are newspaper clippings on, you know, media issues and media themes that go back really into the 60s. And, you know, and I think are fascinating. Oh, no, we don't need that. You know, we have Google. We can just Google all of this. And, you know, we don't need, you know, this file, because this was, you know, and I said, what? You know, you can't just Google this. You have to know what you're looking for. You have to have some idea about. So in a sense, our digital search engine oriented research, in a way, does a disservice to some of these issues. You know, it's time bound, it's culture bound in many ways, and it doesn't really give you the full picture.
And I think also in the case of newspapers from developing country, many of them haven't been digitized. So they're sitting crumbling in libraries around the world. And once they crumble, we're not going to ever be able to see them again. So there's a lot of history that's already been lost.
Now, in terms of this global muckraking effort, do you see a revival of this today with not-for-profit media organizations like ProPublica, for example, or, you know, organizations that are encouraging more investigative journalism in various parts of the world?
Yes, absolutely. So having read 100 years' worth of newspapers, I'm actually now much more cheerful about the journalism than I was when I started. And I think in some ways, like my last book about business journalists, maybe I was almost too harsh. And when I have that, now that I've got this historical perspective. So because of the book, I'm now in touch with a lot of investigative journalism organizations that I didn't know before. And I've been speaking at conferences of investigative journalists as well. And I think there's a lot of people would say that there's a flowering of investigative journalism right now. Certainly Sheila Cornell, who's from the Philippines and runs the investigative journalism program at Columbia Journalism School, which calls it a golden age. And I think there's about five reasons why we're seeing more investigative journalism now than we have for a while. I think that certainly there's more data and information out there. And for journalists who are in newsrooms where there isn't a lot of money, they can get more online. There's a lot of journalists in this world who can't afford to travel to places to go get stories, and are dependent on their sources or on big businesses, you know, taking them on a tour of the coal mine or whatever. So the internet has helped people get more information. The internet has helped journalists connect to their sources around the world and to each other. So there's a lot more cross-border investigations, like the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project or SCOOP. There's philanthropy as well. There's big donors who are giving money for journalism, people like, you know, Pierre Omidyar supporting First Look Media, and he's also supporting Sahar Reporters, which is a Nigerian website run by a Nigerian activist who lives in New York and gets leaks about corruption.
Yeah, we profiled Sahar Reporters on Media Channel.
Yeah, so you know him. And then I think also in many countries there's been revolutions or some kind of political transition, and when there's upheaval, that often means there's more journalism. And then I think those are probably some of the main reasons that we're seeing more. And then there's, unfortunately, the layoffs and the older generation that have retired from their jobs or been forced out of their jobs. That's a terrible thing. But many of them are now mentoring the next generation. So I think there's five factors that have come together.
And let's not forget the bloggers, you know.
Absolutely.
Individuals who on their own volition, usually unpaid, and I'm sort of one of them now, you know, actually try to commit journalism online on a regular basis, you know, sometimes maybe in my case too regular every day. But, you know, trying to write about news, trying to fill in the gaps of news, trying to seek out other sources. Because one of the things that you find often is that when you just focus on the American media, you're leaving out a lot of other perspectives about the world and a lot of other voices in the world. This is why outfits like Global Voices Online, for example, you know, are so important, because they're offering us perspectives from people in other countries. And, I early on reached out to a lot of these people to be part of Media Channel. We've never had the funding really to turn it into what it could be. But, you know, we had 1,000 affiliates at one point of people who wanted to be in touch with each other, wanted to learn from each other, wanted to share information. And sometimes when you put together a global reporting project, you bring lots of different different sensibilities into the picture, and people who can look into things. You know, and we're seeing today with the crisis in the Ukraine, for example, with the financial crisis, which goes on and on and on and on. You know, an over-reliance on certain sources and an under-appreciation of certain questions, let's say, that are really important to helping us understand more clearly what's happening.
Yeah, well, I completely agree with you about bloggers. And in the 19th century, people like you might have existed, but they had to have a printing press, and they would print a little newsletter or newspaper, and not that many people would see it. So I agree with you that now there's way more ability to get the ideas out, and there's way more information out there, too. Now, as you know, attention spans are fragmented, so it can be really hard to sort of build outrage.
But, you know, you teach at Columbia. I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'm just thinking of your students and the students that you've interacted with. Aren't they sort of partial to the big media brands because, you know, they want to get into careers in journalism and they want to, you know, be part of the whole big media system? Or are there a number of them who are really interested in exploring other approaches to journalism?
I would say that they're getting jobs in a whole range of places. I don't teach at the journalism school, so I can't speak for them. I teach at the School of International and Public Affairs. And smaller places, people are setting things up on their own, and there's much less job security than there used to be. So I'm finding with my students that they're turning over jobs more quickly. But I think they're open to anything. I mean, they basically want a paycheck.
You know, we have, for example, the emergence of Vice Media. I don't know if you've followed this at all. You know, being funded, big companies just throwing money at them, you know, because they're so hip and they have a youth audience that a lot of news doesn't have. So, you know, this guy Shane Smith has been a very good marketer and salesman for Vice Media. But a lot of the Vice Media programming that I've seen is very short on context and background and very long on, you know, kind of hot video and confrontations and gotcha moments and this sort of thing that doesn't necessarily help you understand the story or care more deeply about it.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to, at the risk of sounding old-fashioned, I'd like to say that let's not forget the mainstream media and some of the investigative journalism being published in places like the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune or the Associated Press or even Bloomberg Businessweek. Some of the best stories I've seen in the last few years come from these outlets.
Well, I've been doing a book about surveillance, and I just did a TV series about it, and I'm doing a book now, and, you know, looking into the coverage of the Snowden leaks and all of that. And some of it is extremely impressive. You know, I mean, Glenn Greenwald and company with First Look Media, but also, you know, Barton Gellman at the Washington Post, who's been an incredibly solid, you know, journalist. At the same time, we have a big shakeup at the Washington Post with a former Reagan administration bureaucrat and the head of the Reagan's foundation now taking over as publisher of the Post, Politico being very skeptical, if not downright critical, of all the, you know, national security journalism, basically saying, you know, it's time to move on. We've, you know, let's end this, you know, infatuation with secrets and all the rest of it. So there's a real clash in the media. It's almost the battleground itself between competing views of what's important.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And I agree with you that the surveillance and the privacy questions are absolutely tremendous, and they're not getting the coverage that they deserve. And that would be true certainly online. For example, I don't know if you've done a program on the new Brazilian law that got passed in the spring.
I've heard about it. Tell
us
about
it. Yeah,
well,
it's very interesting. It's much more pro-privacy, more pro, I'm not an expert, you know, net neutrality. There's a lot of things in that law that we could learn from in the United States. And yet there hasn't really been all that much coverage. I did see some things on NPR. So I think that in a way, the U.S. attitude towards a lot of the regulation of the Internet has been a sort of standard. It's a bit like the sort of UNESCO battles, you know, in the 70s and in the 80s with Reagan. So the U.S. attitude has been, let's not regulate. The sort of Google attitude is, you know, let's not have walled gardens. But I think there are other countries that are trying to do things that we could actually really learn from.
Well, particularly when we see a medium, if you call it that, or a network like, you know, the internet writ large, also becoming a tool of spying and surveillance, that's very, in a sense, discouraging. That you know, a tool for the emancipation of humanity and freedom, also at the same time becoming a tool of collecting private data from people and, you know, using that data for a variety of nefarious purposes. So, you know, you have two sides almost to everything. You have the positive side of, isn't this a thrill that we're able to, you know, read newspapers from all over the world, for, you know, mm-hmm. just by clicking? Isn't it a thrill that we're able to watch voices of people from all over the world? And at the same time, what we're finding is often the hard-hitting journalism is on the comedy shows, not, you know, in the investigative programs. I mean, 60 Minutes, one of the great programs, you know, historically in America, you know, went and took us on a guided tour of the NSA and was sort of a NSA sales pitch as opposed to an investigation of the NSA. So there's, you know, a way in which a lot of big media is very unhappy with independent voices getting on the air, with people who are more critical and skeptical being heard. And as a consequence, we have the same ideas being reframed. I just wrote a column today, you know, for my website, newsdissector.net, plug. And what it is, it's about how in England, David Cameron, the prime minister, has basically smeared Vladimir Putin with the Hitler brush. Suddenly he's Hitler, and this writer for The Guardian went back and showed how in almost every, how this has been used repetitively and continually to sort of discredit people we don't like by branding them as a Hitler. And it's a goal is to silence debate, not to encourage it.
Mm. Well, that sounds real. I'm really glad to see that, because I think that historical perspective on media coverage is actually really, really important. I think that, you know, obviously I don't want to say that corporate media is a wonderful thing or that television, we're going to get the news we need from television. But I do think that with careful reading, there's a lot out there. May I give you some examples of great stories
please,
that I've read?
Please.
Yeah.
Cheer me up, Anya. Cheer me up.
I know. It's funny to be so cheerful about this subject. It's not what how most people feel about the media. But I'm you know, many people, including myself, help judge the Overseas Press Club Awards every spring. And this is an incredible experience because it means you read literally hundreds of pieces of journalism mm-hmm. and catch up on all kinds of things. So for the last 2 years, I've been helping judge the Human Rights Journalism mm-hmm. Prize. And the stories are incredible. I mean, there was a series from the Associated Press about Honduras mm-hmm. and what the drug gangs were doing and how people were getting forced out of their houses and shaken down, and it had gotten so bad in some communities people didn't want to even paint their house or mow their lawn because the drug gangs would come and force them out. Now, this series came out, I think, 2 years ago. And when everything happened this year with the whole controversy about those children coming across the border, were there more of them? Weren't there more of them? Why were they coming? I thought back, this is an incredible piece of journalism, a whole entire series that you can find online, and really went a long way to explain the background of the situation. I also, if I can give another example, E. Benjamin Skinner took a report by a New Zealand academic called Glenn Simmons and wrote about basically slavery on the fishing ships in the Tasman Sea. They were recruiting indigenous Indonesian workers, bringing them to work on these ships that were run by South Koreans but flagged to New Zealand and supplying to U.S. companies. And when the workers got on, they were basically exploited, abused. Some of them were raped, and they were underpaid. Now, this story came out in Business Week, Bloomberg Business Week, and within months, New Zealand had acted to change their laws, and these big American food companies had started investigating their supply chain. So stories like that, which I agree, the normal person wouldn't see. You'd have to look for them. But there is remarkable journalism.
Well, obviously,
I remain
a journalist, and I'm doing this program and continuing with MediaChannel.org because I believe believe in the value and importance of it, obviously, and wish more people did. And certainly I'm also encouraged by media taking the lead on the Snowden story, media taking the lead on many other stories. I was also part of, you know, some group of journalists who began to challenge the dominant kind of paradigm about why we had a financial crisis, and it's a battle that's still taking place. And I'm sure that, you know, you're married to a leading economist who must get up in the morning, feeling sometimes like, you know, here he has done so much work explaining all of this that tends to get ignored by so many because they don't want to deal with the implications.
You know, Danny, it's funny because I think your work on the financial crisis is actually really important. And I'm writing a paper right now that looks at sort of all the scholarship and media criticism of the press coverage of the financial crisis. And I actually have a footnote of, I'm footnoting some of your work. And
I made a footnote. Well, okay, great.
Okay. You did more than that, I'm definitely happy to cite you about that.
You know, but it was, you know, when I started doing it, you know, I did a film called In Debt We Trust, showing how the economy had been changed from, you know, like an economy built on production to one built on consumption, where all these people were getting deeper and deeper in debt and all the rest of it. And when it came out, the perspective was, are you nuts? Things have never been better. How can you be so negative, you know, about the economy? Then, you know, 6 months later, the market collapsed. Suddenly I went from being, you know, an idiot to being a genius. You know, how did you know this was going to happen? And I'm just saying that this effort is that there's also this seems to be a flight from reality by some in the media. They don't want to deal with something that they either consider depressing or they don't have an answer for. And so as a consequence, they skirt around some of the real dilemmas and challenges that we're facing, you know, and in a way, these global muckrakers that you highlight, you know, going back to 1600, were voices in the wilderness in many cases in their own cultures at the time. And yet, you know, all these years later, we look back at them with a lot of admiration.
Well, that's actually one of the things that I got questions that I started to try to answer as I was thinking about the book, and I address in my introduction is, why is it that sometimes the journalism really has an impact and sometimes it is completely ignored, or as you say, people just go back to it later? So that's one of the things that we really explore, is under what conditions. And each piece of journalism in the book, there's 47, has an introduction that kind of examines that context. Often, as you know, the journalism on its own is never going to be enough. Often it had an impact because there was a larger social movement and other activists. And one of the things that I found in the book that surprised me, although maybe it shouldn't have, was that there was often a close relationship between the journalists and the campaigners and the advocates, that they were helping them with information or data or tipping them off to things.
But wouldn't those people today be saying, you're not really a journalist, you're an activist, you're a partisan, you're an advocate, you don't have the dispatched, you know, the detachment that a journalism requires. I mean, Glenn Greenwald has been denounced this way by many of his, quote, colleagues in big media who, you know, see him as being a troublemaker, basically.
Yeah, and certainly there's an argument that, oh, gee, the lines have gotten so blurred. Isn't it terrible? You know, nowadays, if you want to have the New York Times doesn't have enough foreign correspondents. If you want to know something, you have to, you know, about labor conditions of Philippine workers in the Middle East, you have to read a Human Rights Watch report. Gee, is that journalism? And I think one of the things that I found from my book was that those ties were always there. And that's not to undermine the journalists at all or to say they didn't do important work, because they did. But often they were getting help and support and information from campaigners.
And let's not forget forgive, you know, the murders of the two journalists in the last 2 weeks. And both of them, who were, quote, beheaded, were also freelancers. They were there because our big media companies either can't afford to or don't want to put people into the field in dangerous situations. And so, You know, we have to respect and remember their contribution and recognize that because they were killed does not mean that these stories will not be covered. And I think your efforts to offer historical perspective way more than most people would ever think of investigating deserves a lot of appreciation and a lot of praise. The book is Global Muckraking, 100 Years Investigative Journalism from Around the World. Who published it?
New Press.
The U Press?
New Press.
The New Press, which, of course, was a great publishing and is a great publishing company with which I think you've been associated for many years, as was your father, who is one of the great, you know, men in my experience in journalism, and rather in publishing and courage in publishing. So, Anya Shiffrin, thank you very much for joining me. We could go on with this conversation. Maybe we can pick it up in the future, but it's certainly fun to have this conversation with someone who knows so much and cares so deeply. Anya Shiffrin, here on Media Channel Radio.
Danny, thank you very much. Thank you.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
40 sanity stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned babies.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans to see? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does it speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's at the door, and that's what entertainment's for. It's the drug of the century, the soul penitentiary.
Did you find you lost your virginity at the same time?
Kindness, right? And ratings pressures.
News scoop,
what we need to know.
News scoop,
what we want to know.
We got news scoop,
what we think we know.
But the more we watch, the less we know. Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor.
Till freedom is a rumor.
News scoop,
what we need to know.
News scoop,
what we want to know.
We've got news scoop,
what we think we know.
Got remote control to choose a show. But the more we...
On the one hand, there's the public's right to know. On the other hand...
On the other hand, good question. What is on the other hand? I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on Media Channel Radio. And now, as NATO meets in South Wales to talk about the dangers of the Russian bear and of the risks of war in the Ukraine and the need for some sort of united front against the threat and of represented by Vladimir Putin, we meet on the radio here to discuss what's behind this Ukraine crisis, what's not being reported in the American media, and what better person to talk about it with than Robert Parry, Bob Parry, editor of Consortium News, somebody who's been following this story with great diligence and detail in the same way that he did years back when he was documenting the incredible Iran-Contra story and was almost the lead investigative journalist on it. Now he's playing that role on the Ukraine crisis, and his work is available online at Consortium News and many other websites. He talks about the whys behind the Ukraine crisis, who's telling the big lie on Ukraine, and maybe right now, Bob, you can give us your take on this NATO meeting that is getting underway in South Wales, where the members of NATO are mobilizing to deal with Putin and to really foster more confrontation and polarization on this issue.
Well, hi, Danny. I guess there'll probably be quite a Putin-bashing extravaganza going on this week. And that's been sort of what's been going on in the U.S. media for now months. What's been extraordinary about the Ukraine crisis is that it probably was something that never could have, that never should have gotten to be a serious problem to begin with. But a big factor has been how the U.S. news media has applied a very one-sided black hat, white hat narrative to a much more nuanced and complex story. But that's been how the American people have been told this story, that there is this It's all been about Putin somehow deciding to reconstruct the Soviet Union, that he's that he had some diabolical plan to retake Ukraine and then move on to Estonia and the Baltic states, and therefore the NATO has to step in to sort of push back. And
is there any
America
real evidence for that?
Done.
Is there any
no,
real
there's
evidence?
None. There's none. It's one of the most extraordinary myths that we've seen in really modern times. I mean, there have been plenty of times in recent years when the U.S. news media has gotten things really completely wrong, obviously most notably in 2002 and 2003 on Iraq. But it's also happened on Syria a year ago, the Russian judgment about the sarin attack, with how the approach toward the Iran nuclear program, much of that was misreported. And here we are. Here we have on a much more, even more sensitive matter, where we have a nuclear-armed state in Russia facing other nuclear-armed states, particularly the United States. And the same sloppy reporting has been developed. The real fact about the Ukraine crisis was that the West instigated it. And particularly some of the neocons were instrumental in instigating it. You had a year ago in September of 2013, the National Endowment for Democracy President Carl Gershman, one of the most prominent neocons in many ways in Washington, took to the op-ed page of the Washington Post to declare that Ukraine was going to be, quote, the biggest prize. And he said it was really an interim step to eventually taking out Putin.
So these guys have their own foreign, they have their own foreign policy, you know, think tanks and approach, and they're funded by the U.S. government, but they go whatever way they want to go, right? I mean,
they also have a great amount of power within the U.S. government. They still do, Danny. They and really throughout our news media, there never was an accountability after the Iraq War. Very few people, probably can count them on one finger of one hand. I guess Judy Miller of the New York Times suffered any consequence for getting the Iraq War story wrong. But many of the key people who got it wrong, whether it's Michael Gordon at the New York Times or Fred Hyde of the Washington Post editorial page, people like that are still in place, many of them in the exact same place they were. So they're doing much the same things. So you have the neocons maintaining a tremendous amount of influence. Plus, they even within the Obama administration, they never were really purged. There was, you have someone like a Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, a very strong neocon who worked for Dick Cheney, being one of the key people involved in developing the policy toward Ukraine. So you have this idea going back to the beginning, and the Europeans played a role too, of going after Ukraine and using it as a way to go after Putin. So what everyone thinks of Putin, he wasn't the instigator of this crisis. He was consistently reacting to it. And there's no evidence at all that he had any plans to go seize territory, that he was planning to, you know, go into the Baltic states. Yet that has been the narrative that's been sold to the American people.
I mean, I've been sort of struck by the fact that here we go again in comparing Putin as we compared Saddam to Hitler. You know, Owen Jones of The Guardian was commenting on a statement by the British Prime Minister David Cameron, comparing what's happening today to Munich in 1938. And he says, here we go again. The West comparing the latest enemy number in the to the German Führer. It has been a standard tactic for decades. When Egypt's General Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal, Britain's Prime Minister compared him to Hitler. Serbia's Slobodan Milosevic was the Hitler of the late 90s, and the U.S. dabbled with describing the former Iranian president, Ahmadinejad, as a Hitler. On the eve of the Iraq War, Saddam Hussein was repeatedly compared to Hitler. So is this a kind of a playbook that they have, and they just sort of take it out and just dust it off and use it again and again to try to demonize the people they're opposing and distort what they're about and why they're what they're doing?
Right, Danny. I think there's a game on the internet where the first person who uses the Hitler analogy loses. But what you're now seeing is being applied. It gets applied geopolitically. And you have someone like a Hillary Clinton coming out and drawing, using the Hitler comparison relating to Putin. But it is incredibly misapplied here. But it goes to how powerful the groupthink is in Washington. If you stand up and say, hold it, that is ridiculous, that comparison is not fitting here, you get called names, you get called your Russian apologist, much as if you said, hold it, Saddam Hussein may be a very bad guy, but he's not Hitler, you'd be a Saddam apologist. So there's kind of a way of browbeating and insulting people in Washington. I've been here since the 70s and was here during the 80s when it was often used, that you'd be a Sandinista apologist if you tried to describe honestly what was happening in Nicaragua. So there was always this game that was played. And obviously one of the tactics is to use the Hitler analogy. And then once someone's called Hitler, what can you say in sort of trying to offer a more nuanced image? The real situation with Putin is that he actually was trying to be helpful to President Obama in dealing with some very difficult international crises. It was just a year ago, that when the United States was on the verge of rushing into another war, a war with Syria, over the mysterious sarin attack, which we still don't know who really carried it out. It could well have been the rebels, some of these extremist rebels who were involved in it, but we still don't know for a fact. But there was this rush to judgment that it was done by the Syrian government, and it was Putin who offered President Obama a way out of that crisis rather than having to go to war again. It was Putin who sort of arranged to get the Syrians to surrender all their chemical weapons, and gave the U.S. a path out of the crisis. Similarly, he helped on Iran. He was helpful in getting the Iranians to agree to accept really tight constraints on their nuclear program and get us out of another tight spot we were in at that point. So in a way, Putin became a bête noire to the neocons because he was helping the United States solve some very tricky problems. And that's why I think it's very interesting that roughly a year ago, the neocons begin this campaign to go after Ukraine, to try to pry it loose in a very provocative way from the Russian orbit and sort of use that as a way to discredit or hurt Putin. And what, of all the things that have been done, that's certainly been successful in this case, is that the neocons have blown up the relationship, the very constructive relationship that Obama and Putin had developed behind the scenes. That, of course, now is pretty well shot. But it's a very dangerous move because Putin was very helpful in trying to resolve some of these other very thorny problems.
So what happens now? I mean, you know, is there any chance of a rapprochement in any of this? I mean, you hear the Iranian leaders who had been trying to negotiate with the United States now saying, you know, you just can't trust the United States. They will do everything and anything they can to spoil the possibilities of any agreement as they have with new sanctions being imposed on Iran or new sanctions being imposed on Russia. It seems as if, you know, the whole thrust of the policy is a throwback to the Cold War, to who can be toughest, who can use the more kind of militaristic rhetoric. Isn't that what we're seeing here?
Yes, I think again, you have many of the neocons never wanted these problems resolved, at least not in the way that others might hope for, a more peaceful area of compromise. And certainly compromises are difficult in these situations. No one's saying it would be easy to get a compromise solution in Syria, for instance. But that is probably the way that would lead to the fewer additional people being killed. But the neocons, certainly since the days of going after Saddam and having regime change in Iraq, then targeted Syria for regime change. And they targeted Iran for regime change.
And
so
Libya.
The idea of working out some kind of settlement with these countries that isn't 100% get rid of their governments and put somebody else in has not been something that the neocons want. They want to basically take them out. And so when anyone gets in the way of that, there's this tendency to try to disrupt and destroy that process. Now, Obama has been sort of caught in somewhat the middle. He was actually working behind the scenes with Putin, understanding that this was a way to resolve some of these difficulties and get them off the table, in his view. But he wasn't willing to really challenge even people within his own administration who were trying to be provocative. And that's where I think Ukraine makes some sense, because if you try to figure it out other ways, it really doesn't make a lot of sense. But if you look at it as an effort by part of the U.S. government to sort of get a momentum going to make it really impossible for Obama and Putin to work together in resolving these other thorny problems, then you see why it has some logic to it. Otherwise, it's kind of a crazy thing, because essentially the issue here was whether or not President Yanukovych, who had been elected, was going to sign this agreement with the EU to have an association, or whether he'd accept a more generous package from Moscow in terms of $15 billion. And he was inclined to do the former. He was inclined to sign with the EU, but then the IMF steps in and says, well, as part of that, you're going to have to accept some very draconian reforms, which meant that things would be a lot harder for the already hard-pressed people.
So-called structural adjustment programs.
Exactly, the usual stuff. So he said, no, I don't want to do that. And then there was this movement that was built, and much of it was legitimate. Much of it was people just angry about their conditions, the corruption. Many of the young people wanted visa-free travel to Europe. They didn't want to go through the process that they had. So there were a lot of reasons that they were angry. But you also had other elements that were trying to destabilize and overthrow the elected government. That included some of the neo-Nazi groups that were operating from Western Ukraine, that were training people to go into the Maidan, and they became the muscle, ultimately, to carry out these attacks against the police.
Why didn't we read about any of those neo-Nazis in our media? I mean, there were some reports, but very few.
Right. Well, the U.S. news media very quickly made this a black hat, white hat story, where the people in the Maidan were the white hats and President Yanukovych was the black hat. He was backed by the bigger black hat, Vladimir Putin. So you had that sort of narrative imposed. Now, if you read carefully some of the stories, you will see, even in the New York Times and certainly BBC and other places, writing about the key role the neo-Nazis played. When things got worse at the Maidan run in February, the neo-Nazi groups went to the fore with Molotov cocktails. They attacked the police. They killed a number of police. The police struck back. There was this mysterious sniper fire that no one really still to this day knows who fired it, but killed a number of police and demonstrators. And and that then touched off the worsening crisis. Yanukovych then agreed to surrender power. Agreed to reduce his power and have an early election so he could be voted out of office. That was on February 21st. The agreement was guaranteed by three European governments. But once he pulled back his police, at the request, by the way, of Vice President Biden, the neo-Nazi militias moved to the fore, seized presidential buildings, and essentially drove these guys to flee and controlled the government for a while. And then ultimately, some of them were incorporated into the government.
So
but
it
we
was.
Really
it was.
Because,
so Bob, it was. It was a coup. You know, I mean, it could be described as a coup, couldn't it?
Yes, it was a coup. But again, this is not a story that the New York Times or the Washington Post wanted to tell the American people. They wanted to make it a nice little story of noble people in the Maidan rising up against a corrupt leader. We sort of ignore the fact that he was elected, and this was a democracy promotion movement, it was called, even though it was overthrowing a democratically elected leader. I mean, it was a lot of the same kind of propaganda from the U.S. side that we have seen in other cases, where if you go back and look at our bends in Guatemala or Mossadegh in Iran, I know these are issues you know very well, Dan.
Well, Milosevic, even.
These are cases, if you go back and look at how those were reported at the time, these, even though they were elected leaders, they were portrayed as tyrants and people that were somehow opposed by masses of their people. When often these were organized by the CIA or other outside forces to get these folks overthrown. And we've done something similar in Ukraine, and that sort of set this in motion. This idea of a coup regime seizing power, disenfranchising the ethnic Russians in the east. Ultimately, they rose up. They were, instead of being negotiated with, the Kiev government decided they would call it a anti-terrorism operation, and they attacked. And so we've had a lot of people losing their lives. Thousands of now have been killed.
So here's a question that I have now right now for people who are listening to this. It's complex. It is complex. There's an East. There's a West. There's the pro, you know, kind of government forces. There's the anti-government forces. There's the Russian speakers. There's the Ukrainian speakers. There's Vladimir Putin, who everybody in our country thinks is running the whole show, which he clearly is not. Okay. And then, of course, on the American side, we have, you know, the neocons and the Obama administration and the role of the press and everything else. What questions should we be asking as media consumers about what's going on here? How can we really learn about it? I mean, it's a fascinating story, and I think you've done an excellent job of demystifying it and explaining it. But what kinds of questions do you think the public should be asking about all of this?
Well, I think the public has a right to be demanding a much more objective, professional account from their news media. We've had not only the larger issue grossly distorted and some very important stories not told because they conflict with the desired narrative, but we've also seen serious factual mistakes. Michael Gordon, for instance, at the New York Times was part of a story about these photographs that were shown, this is back a few months, supposedly showing soldiers in Russia and then in Ukraine, and these were being palmed off by the Kiev government and by the U.S. State Department. It led the New York Times. This is like a lead story of the New York Times, these photographs proving that the Russian special forces had gone into Ukraine. And it turned out that the photographs that were supposedly taken in Russia actually had been taken in Ukraine. So all the photographs were taken in Ukraine. So it wasn't. So you had this embarrassing failure, but a rush to use the information by the New York Times because it fit the propaganda theme that the New York Times had.
You know, I mean, just recently we had
this. And that should be stopped. There should be real consequences.
I mean, I was
not just allowing it to be sloughed off.
I was amazed recently when the president, of Ukraine, gave a speech, and you know, it was reported that he was accusing Russia of invading Ukraine. And later, Reuters issued a clarification and said they mistranslated what he had said, that he hadn't used the word invasion. But in our media, it seems as if few distinctions were made. You know, an incursion is an invasion. And, you know, there was an attempt to blame it all on Putin.
Right. And what is also quite scary is that this is playing with matches, but they're nuclear matches. And your countries here on both sides, the United States particularly, and Russia, of course, which are armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons. And now, sure, you hope that cooler heads prevail and that things don't escalate. But we know that when you start moving into this propaganda world and you start putting pressure on and things happen, like the plane in the Malaysia airline plane got shot down. We still don't know quite how it happened, but we know that probably it looks because this conflict was going on the ground. Someone took it down with a missile, perhaps accidentally or perhaps not. But
and amazingly enough, there never has been, you know, a credible international investigation of what happened. So as almost as if, you know, nobody wants one.
Well, again, it was pinned very quickly on the Russians. But I was told this, and I sort of didn't really want to go as quickly with the information I was getting. But since the U.S. government was jumping to conclusions, including Secretary of State Kerry going on the five talk shows and saying, he as a prosecutor, he knows the Russians did it. Basically, I was hearing from inside U.S. intelligence that the information was much murkier. That in fact they were leaning more to thinking that it was carried out by someone in the Ukrainian government, perhaps an accident there too, but again, these are things that you'd hope would be carefully examined, in particular because of the nuclear trigger that we have dealing with in this case. What we're sort of counting on, oddly, is Putin not getting really angry, even though we call him a madman. We're acting almost like he better be the most rational guy in the room, and just sit there and be insulted and humiliated day after day and not strike back. But sometimes leaders do go kind of berserk, and they do move to a different level. But at this point, that's sort of the risk we're taking, is that we're instead of trying to resolve this crisis, which actually could be very easily resolved based on allowing a certain amount of self-determination for the people of eastern Ukraine, which seems pretty reasonable in most Americans because we have this, we have that sort of a system here, a federalized system. But that's being essentially rejected, or has been rejected, by the Kiev government. And instead, there's been this effort to just attack them with what they called an anti-terrorist operation. And perhaps, Danny, one of the most remarkable stories not being told is, and this, I found this in the last three paragraphs of a New York Times article a couple of weeks ago, and the London Telegraph did a much longer piece. But for the first time since World War II, a government has knowingly unleashed Nazi militias on their population. Some of the lead fighters are these stormtroopers from Western Ukraine, who have been incorporated into the military, and they're actually marching on Ukrainian towns in Eastern Ukraine under banners where they have SS Nazi SS insignia.
I don't know what
Azov battalion, and so that strikes me as a really interesting story.
Well, certainly anyone familiar with history of the Holocaust knows the Ukrainians were particularly vicious, or many of their units were very vicious in enforcing the Holocaust with the Nazis. It's not, you know, a surprise in a sense that tradition continues. But what is important to me, Bob, is the work that you're doing, Consortium News is doing, and a handful of journalists around the world doing to try to get at the truth of this particular situation. And, you know, there's so many layers of propaganda to cut through. There's so much demonization going on. There's so much Putin bashing going on. And now we're going to see more of it as NATO convenes. But clearly, we need more truth here. And I really would recommend the work that you're doing on Consortium News. Thank you so much, Robert Parry, for joining us.
Thanks, Danny.
So thank you again for listening. Media Channel Radio here on PRN. Also, please let me hear from you. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org with your suggestions and your comments about what we're trying to do. This is a unique media critical program every week, trying to get at what's behind the news and what we're not being told. And I appreciate your being here with us. MediaChannel.org, my blog, newsdissector.net. Thank you again for listening.